Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're gonna learn today.
Innovate like a startup, deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeed up and ready because it's gonna be a great day.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Oh yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 145. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Aero, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, happy Veeam Day, buddy.
It is Veeam Day, man. You know, I need to get all my Philips Hue lights like just shooting green like across. Although I think we've discussed this, like human beings, green is not the most flattering on pasty, you know, human skin here.
But, yeah, that's true. That's true. You see the size of my drinking cup?
Oh man, that is a green drinking cup.
Yeah,
I'm drinking this energy drink, which, you know, Minotaur, which is I think green. So we'll
that can't be good for you.
Hold on, we haven't introduced you yet. You can't talk yet.
Oh shit! Sorry.
This is why Zoom records multi-channel and we can delete one person.
Yeah, man. So yeah, V10 comes out today. If you don't know that, you need to definitely be going to go.veeam.com/V10. They're doing a big launch there. They're going to talk all about it. But hey, if you're not there, you're in luck because we have two of the Veeam monsters themselves here. Two of our favorite friends from Veeam, Mr. Michael Cade. Michael, welcome back to the podcast.
Hey, guys. How's it going?
Good man, good man. And your partner in crime, our good friend, Mr. Anthony Spiteri. Anthony, welcome back.
Hey guys, good to be back.
So, big day, man. V10. How long have we been talking about version 10?
A long time. Yeah. Feels like just shy of 3 years, because it is just shy of 3 years.
Yeah.
No. Obviously, it's been a long time, but it's finally here, and it's going to be a really big release. I'm really happy that it's finally just out, and I'm not going to say behind us because while it's taken a long time, we've had so much happen in the last 3 years in terms of the 9.5 releases. They weren't small. They were significant unto their own. So to have V10 is an equally significant release, but to get up to that version number, it's really good for us. So yeah, really excited.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. So I don't even know where to begin because it's funny. Thank you for letting us be part of the Vanguard program. So we've had early access to V10 for a while and we got to see it firsthand, but I don't even know where to begin. Let's see. You guys have updates to NAS that I want to talk about. I want to talk about multi-VM instant recovery. I want to talk about cloud tier because I know there's been some updates there, but man, why don't we just start with NAS? Cade, what's new in V10 with NAS?
Yeah. So this goes back to the whole waiting for V10, right? So we announced it at VMon 2017, but back then there was five things, right? There was agent management to be centralized within Veeam Backup Replication. There was the cloud tier piece that was released at the beginning of 2019. There was the universal storage API that integrates with you guys, but through to our Pure Storage, the NetApps, etc., to give us a bit better way of being able to transfer the data and get a faster backup. And then there was two others. There was NAS backup, which is finally here, and I'll talk about that shortly. And then there's CDP outstanding. So we'll get back to that later. But so from a NAS backup point of view, why is it different? Why has it taken so long? So we could have ticked a box 2 years ago and we could have said, right, we're going to do this NDMP. We're going to do the traditional way. We're going to tick the box and win a load of RFPs because we could do something around NAS backup. But that wouldn't be a Veeam thing to do, right? One of the things that we always strive to do is change the way the industry does it, because it's not always the best way. The fact is that, so we want to obviously be a software-defined approach to be able to protect any NAS device. So whether that's SMB, whether it's NFS, whether it's a Windows file server, or whether it's a SMB or Linux file server. So being able to protect that, completely agnostic to what it is, but also from a scalability point of view. So being able to look at billions of files, petabytes of data. And the biggest challenge of all is, well, how do we make that happen? So if we look at NDMP, that old technology that actually end of life in 2010, so 10 years ago, a lot of our competition still using that. The biggest challenge there is that they have to take that full backup, they have to walk the file system every single time, and then they can only take minimal incremental backup thereafter. So what we needed to be able to take really fast incremental backups of our NAS. So day one, we have to take a full backup. But we use something called change file tracking, very similar to change bot tracking, which we do in your world, in the vSphere world.
Yeah.
And that allows us to understand what's changed since the last backup. So we don't have to go and traverse the whole file system. But on top of that, the workers or the proxies, the file proxies that we use to get as many concurrent tasks through as possible, well, they can be virtual, they can be physical. The caveat today is that they have to be Windows machines, but we can scale that out on day one to get the fastest full backup, because then everything thereafter is going to be an incremental backup and a very fast incremental backup.
Yeah, that's the big thing, man. Obviously, when you're taking backups, you know, you want them to be quick. They need to be fast. And there's other technologies, depending on what you're backing up, that have those instantaneous snapshots, that have that, like you said, the change block tracking to make it so it's just a very quick backup. So it's nice to see that you guys are adding that into some of your other backups. You mentioned a lot of different programs that are being backed up. John, what do you think about that from a VMware perspective?
You know, I was actually looking around for an NFS backup tool. I needed it for something I was working on. this could be, I may need to get this installed here. One thing I was just going to ask about is I like that, first off, that you didn't just go down the NDMP route for trying to do fast backup. NDMP just has, I don't know, it's something that kind of scarred me dealing with troubleshooting in a past life, as well as if you need to rehydrate certain things, you end up kind of having to have the source filer and stuff like that. One thing I was going to ask is, you were talking about, so we got this incremental backup, which is obviously fast. You just look at the metadata, figure out if files have changed. Then you've got the ability to scale out workers. Awesome. The third thing I was going to ask about is, how do you measure when I need to add more workers? Or how I know Veeam historically had the ability to kind of identify bottlenecks. Is that something that we have with file? How do we figure out when it's time to add more workers? Or if my NAS just sucks, I've got two spinning, you know, drives in it, and it's the bottleneck.
Yeah. So we implemented this very close to RC release, right? So we wanted to be agnostic. So yeah, we want to play with the big enterprise filers that are out there, but we understand that a lot of our mid-market commercial customers and even SMB are going to be running various different other lower end, let's call them lower end NAS devices. And we were finding that in our testing, when we were testing against one of them, let's call them a lower end NAS device, we were actually over throttling and killing the production NAS, which won't go down very well, right? Yeah, okay, we get a backup, but no one can work anymore.
So the backup is too fast, is what you're saying. It's gone plaid and it's crushing all the normal workloads.
Yeah, so we'll out of the box pre-RC, we're going to absolutely take as much throughput, as much of the concurrent tasks as we can take. So what we implemented was actually a backup IO control, so that we can choose where we sit on that scale.
Oh, nice.
And choose how much CPU and how many threads that we actually take from that. And today it's a manual task. There'll be defined best practice around this. But expect to see later on this be just encompassed. So like our backup IO control with you guys and data stores. So we know that we're not encroaching on vSphere environments and vSphere production workloads. We never want to, backup never should be impacting performance on production, right?
Oh yeah.
So what we've done is, so this is an implement, this is a slider that we choose how many concurrent tasks or what actual performance we can get out of that front end NAS. But expect to see that being more automated later on.
Well, and as people are trying to back up more than just once nightly, or you've got data sets that you're just working on 24/7, you got batch jobs, this whole idea of, well, the backup can crush performance, but no one cares when it's running. People want restore points more than once a day now. And this is the kind of thing we need to think about. How do we make the backup IO path play nice? And it's cool to see that you guys have kind of already solved that in the regular VMDK vSphere land, but also in this agnostic way on the file side, which is cool.
Yeah, and that then leads into, so recovery is obviously a massive part of this as well. So some of the challenges that I mentioned around NDMP, they also come back to haunt you again from a restore point of view. So NDMP doesn't allow you to really go to anything else. Like NDMP has to go for like manufacturer. So
yeah, if you backed up from a NetApp with NDMP, you can't restore to an Isilon.
Exactly.
It's not going to happen.
So again, another key differentiator for us is that, well, we needed to be able to restore from, if we're backing up from A, we need to be able to restore back to B. We have to be agnostic from our restore point of view. And the restore functionality that we brought, so there's two kind of table stakes there. One is entire file share restore, and that can go wherever we want that and choose that to go. Then the files and folders, the granularity of being able to go in and take individual folders, files out, and push them back into wherever you want them to go. But the middle one's kind of the interesting one. And this is the quick rollback. And quick rollback, let's think about a ransomware attack, for example. So ransomware attack happens, starts encrypting all of your unstructured data. And from there, you go away, you remediate that. So we don't have an answer to antivirus and remediation of the actual ransomware. But what we do have is obviously a point in time backup of your good files before the ransomware took and before it hit.
Yeah.
What quick rollback looks at is the differential between the last good backup and what's in the file system today. It looks at the modified date and will roll back to a point in time. So that's like a quick rollback, or for the Windows guys out there, like last known good configuration type thing. And that's a really fast way of just putting it back to a delta before then moving on. So it gets us back up and running as fast as possible.
I like it. What about you, Anthony? What are you working on? What's new in V10 for you? Cloud tier, maybe?
Cloud tier, yeah. Well, cloud tier isn't new as a feature, but
yeah, you had it in 9.5 update 4. Is that when it first came
update
out?
Update 4, yeah. So it's actually gone great guns. We've seen tremendous uptake in, you know, the consumption of public cloud storage. So AWS, Amazon S3, Azure Blob, and even on premises S3 compatible. We're in the multi petabytes of usage in a year, and it's just growing exponentially, right? So we're very happy with what it is and what it's doing. And that was based on the move policy that we had. So we released it basically as a move, and you know, just as a quick recap with the clouds here, is that it's basically an extension of our Scale-Up Backup repository, where we now have the concept of a performance tier, which is where your landing zone is as such, and then we have the capacity tier, which is backed by an object storage repository.
Yeah.
And that object storage repository is backed by Amazon S3, Azure Blob, and S3 compatible. And the idea that we had in update 4 was that we effectively set a policy which offloaded data from the performance tier into the actual capacity tier itself. Now, that was great, and it worked, and it really worked to make more efficient that local landing zone, so you could reduce space, because effectively what it did, stripped out all the VBK files, which is our format, of all of the data, leaving a metadata, which left a small shell, and all of the actual proper data for the VMs was sitting on the object storage. And then we were able to reference them through an archive index or a block index. Got really smart about that. Any problem with that was that basically at any one time, there was only one copy of that data. It was either on the performance tier or on the capacity tier, right? So obviously that opened you up a little bit for a potential where people were looking to use this for longer term retention of storage. But if you had a policy set for 30 days and you offloaded things after 30 days, if you had an issue within the first 30 days and a new VM came in there, it might not be offloaded. Mm. So anyway, so we announced a copy mode back when we first announced clouds here back in 2017. But it was, again, part of the initial V1 version of this, not very smart. And again, similar to what Michael talked about with NAS, the ability for us to delay this a little bit has made this one of the more innovative features, more innovative products and ways to actually do object storage for your longer-term retention. So in V10, we have three new capabilities that are coming into the clouds here. One is the copy mode, and then immutability, and also a mount feature. And they're all kind of linked together. They all kind of work together to work towards a certain situation. But basically with a copy mode, we're solving the problem of that, you know, piece of data being either at the capacity tier or the performance tier. Effectively, copy mode works by as soon as a file is created, a backup file is created locally, if copy mode is turned on, it'll copy that file to the capacity tier. So you can think of it as almost an instant replication of a VBK file from your local on-premises to an object storage repository,
okay,
which is that capacity tier. So pretty cool, and it totally then satisfies the 3-2-1 rule of backup. So you know, it's really good from the point of view of being able to instantaneously just know that you've got a complete set of your data offsite on cheaper object storage. And it works together with the move as well. So both can be turned on at the same time. And where that becomes advantageous is we've got the block index and the smart things that we do with that. We've almost got what's akin to source-side dedupe, but we won't upload the same block twice. So obviously in this situation where it works really well is that if you've got a policy set for move for 30 days, you've been copying your files for 30 days. When the particular VBK file reaches that 30-day mark and it needs to be offloaded, all the blocks effectively are going to already be there because we've been copying them. So what we'll do is we won't actually physically copy anything at that point. We'll just reference what's already in the object storage. So really smart. And, you know, on the way back, it's the same thing. So that's really good, really exciting, especially when you put it together with the immutability feature. This is interesting because this kind of protects against malicious intent, right? And I guess admins maybe on their first day don't know what they're doing, going to delete a folder with all the backup files. What we've done with this is that basically anything that gets moved into object storage under that capacity tier and is on Amazon S3 or S3 compatible that supports this particular feature. Now, there's a particular feature in Amazon S3 called versioning and object lock. If that needs to be turned on, okay? And what that does is we basically then, every block that's uploaded, we have a policy set against the object storage repository. It's set to X amount of days. And then for X amount of days, that block or that point is locked and not able to be deleted, totally immutable. And that's also not deleted by, even if you're an Amazon admin, a root user, you cannot delete that file. Okay, so it's really, really locked.
So that
away.
Really makes sure no one's getting rid of
it. You got to call Bezos directly to get rid of it.
Exactly. Yeah,
I did ask about this a while back. Corey Quinn, who's on Twitter and everyone should follow and write snarky things about Amazon billing of like, what happens if someone sets it to like whatever the maximum was, which is like 4 epochs or something. This is the thing to think about. It can get really expensive. I set a petabyte to be immutable forever.
The one caveat that we have a saying, that the cloud isn't a charity, right? But this totally, and we actually do say this.
Cloud isn't a charity. I love that.
We're very good. I might have stolen that for somebody. He knows who he is. But we have this obviously a great way of saying to people, like same way that if you're going to use infrequent access, we tell you it's going to cost more. So we've got a little sort of warning next to it saying, if you click this, you might be up for more costs. So we put it on them, right? And that's really exciting. So that's a really good thing. It's all about protecting the newest backups, okay, really against malicious intent.
Yeah,
and
that's
finally,
good.
Yeah, and then finally we've got the mount option. So this is really cool from the point of view of recoverability because we basically copy all the data into the object storage repository. We also replicate the metadata. So, in fact, we've got a copy of everything in there stored as objects. If you had a disaster on premises, what you could do is spin up a totally new Veeam backup and replication instance, even community edition, and you can effectively mount that object storage repository that you had on premises. And we've made it really easy to import the known restore points into effectively the memory of that VBR server quickly. And then what that means is that you can actually start your recovery process without having to download all the metadata to start with, which could be big depending on the number of restore points. You certainly then don't download the actual data. We stream that down. So it's a pretty cool feature that as well from the DR perspective.
You're reminding me of years ago when I had to do my first like restore from tape with a product that shall remain nameless. And I was like, okay, I've got the tapes, but I don't have the catalog. So I've got to like re-index and sort all this out. And like you guys,
that'll take a week.
I spent 3 days feeding in a closet in like, rural Texas feeding tapes into the system. So I like that you don't have to have like a full licensed version. Like that's another thing awesome. Is that two things. One, hunting down your licensing is the last thing anyone wants to do when there's a smoking crater where the data center was. So that's good. The other thing also is that A lot of people use backup for permanent retention for compliance reasons, which we could argue about that should be in-app versus not. But if you've got data sets and things you're doing that on, you are married. This is like Toigo once said about marriage. Like you have a 20-year marriage with an option to renew. Whatever your compliance is, you have to maintain the ability to rehydrate that data. It's also why one of the things that sucks about NDMP is, okay, I wanted to go from Isilon to NetApp or vice versa. If that data is stored in NDMP, I have to maintain a support agreement and something large enough of that vendor to restore it. And they know that. And they're going to play wacky games with your discounts. So
That's one of our best features, right? The portability of our data format. It is your data. And we even provide the extractor tool, so even in 20, 30, 40 years, you've got access to it. But you're right. It's just about knowing that your data is easily accessible. That's the key here. And, just one point on that as well, just before we move to the next feature, because we've got a couple more, but we're certainly seeing some use cases pick up from the point of view of using VMware Cloud and AWS for this, right?
Oh, yeah.
As an on-demand recoverability solution using the clouds here. So got a couple of customers on the go at the moment who are actually designing around this. So using the cloud tier for on-demand migration into VMC, pretty cool stuff.
Yeah, we actually had we did a cloud migration episode last week, and we had a gentleman on from Round Tower Technologies, Adam Fisher, and he was talking about, you know, he had just recently read a blog from you, Anthony, about, you know, doing some migrations and some backups and restores and stuff to VMC. So I think
actually might have been the one.
Yeah, I think cloud tier. I remember when you first told me about cloud tier a while ago. I saw this as like a great idea that needed a little bit more work. I mean, the idea to move data was fantastic, but I really think that version 10, this is not just a small upgrade. I mean, going from just move to now doing copy, immutable, I mean, and then being able to mount, I mean, that makes that a full solution.
Well, and going back, if we go back to the Stone Ages, when like how you would get your backups into, you know, like just kludging through like the Amazon S3 Gateway or CloudBerry or one of these other things. I remember talking to Anton about this a long time ago. And you guys, honestly, there's other people who push data into the cloud first, but there's a lot of ways to do it wrong. There's a lot of obvious bad ideas once you start looking at it to where, oh my God, I'm going to end up sending the same data over and over again, or I'm going to end up storing the same data, or I'm going to get eaten alive by metadata when I try to defrag an object. Like, there are an infinite amount of ways to make something that's going to cost 10 times what you guys ended up settling on. And so I like that this whole IO, they really thought about the IO path, and they thought about the cost of the IO path in this design. Yeah.
Nice, nice. All right, data integration API. I knew you guys have some changes as it pertains to e-discovery, right, Mike?
Yeah, so the premise behind that, Pete, is around, so obviously backup is first for us, and then recovery is the most important thing after that. But then it's about how do we put that data to work? How can we, like, we've got this data set that's been, let's say it's nearly new from a backup perspective, it's not the production, and it's sat on a storage tier that is invested in for purely for backups. But a lot of our additional functionality comes from a Veeam Data Lab. So prior to that, and this is already in the product today, things like Shore Backup, the ability to verify the recoverability of your backups,
yep,
actually spin them up, automate the spinning up, test against the VM, the app, and the OS, and then send a report and everything's good. Happy days. You've got peace of mind that when you come to that backup, you can restore that, right? On top of that is about how do we offer out a sandbox environment. So this is all involving the whole compute. We need, so the CPU and the memory, and the, we don't need the storage. It's going to come from the backup storage, or it's going to come from a storage snapshot. But we need the resources to be able to spin up that workload in a group, an application stack, if you like, and then be able to give it out to security teams. That's already there today. Then you've got the ability to inject a process with our stage restore, and you've got the ability to interact with antivirus software where we integrate in there so that you know that you're not recovering something that has a ransomware threat in there or a malicious threat.
Yeah.
So what's coming in version 10 is the data integration API. And what that means is, rather than having to spin up all of these virtual machines and using that resource, if we just want to see inside the data disks, what the data integration API allows us to do is take all of our backup sets or a subset of our backup sets, take all of the disks within that and present that to a third party. So yeah, things like e-discovery, but also data classification, understanding what that data is, why are you keeping it? Are you keeping everything for the right reasons? And these are third party tools, right? We're just offering the ability to give out this data set to someone.
So is the data that you're giving to them, does it look different for the different third parties, or is there some sort of format that that you plug into? What does that look like?
So we are pretty much presenting that data as a disk. So it's going to be seen as a mount point within the operating system. And then the third party can then do what they do with that data. But you can see it as your C drive, your D drive, all that data is in there. So really works for unstructured data. And then we could couple that as well with the other data labs tasks that I said, if we do require the compute. But ultimately, that gives us that ability to offer out that data set to other third parties. So expect to see.
Yeah.
So we've been very good from a storage partnership, alliance partnership. That's been our massive ecosystem has been around our alliances. Expect to see a lot more alliances around that data space as well. So
being security, classification. There's a lot of different people who play in that space. It's a very fragmented market. It makes sense why you would partner rather than try to chase every loose end.
Yeah, exactly that.
One question I had on this was so you're presenting block devices, which lots of these systems know what to do with, mount, start scanning, doing things. How would I do like a fan out topology? Like, let's say I had, you know, 500 terabytes I wanted to crawl, and I had, you know, 50 worker nodes, is there a way, what would that look like? Is there, would I script that, or how would I?
Yeah. So actually the whole premise of the feature really is hidden around from a PowerShell script point of view. So we can absolutely do anything around picking and choosing what that disk looks like, where it goes, how many disks in one set of scripts, what workload and what server that goes to, or what third party it goes to.
Yeah. Okay. I've actually tested it up to 120 disks so far. So, and that was off one VBR server. So,
wow.
And that was just me mucking around with a couple of different options. So, yeah.
You're going to bottleneck your Ethernet or your, you know, or your backend storage IO before you're going to bottleneck the amount of mount points.
Well, John, you should know this because you're the storage guy. How many iSCSI mounts can you do on a Windows server?
Oh, God. I know it's over 26 because I've gone all the way to Z.
These are mount points as well. These don't need to go as disks, right?
Yeah.
These are mount points within the...
Yeah.
Like within whatever disk you put it to. So it could be...
Yeah.
Oh, it's clearly 100.
Well, and profoundly dumbfounded. And ideally, you would have multiple repositories feeding this up at a certain point, so it'll be fun. The e-discovery guys always find a way to like create or shift bottlenecks back and forth with those types of those giant like farms that are doing data classification I'm thinking of.
Yeah, the way that I like this, and Michael's talked about it, is it just activates the data, right? That's what it's about. It's otherwise it's data sitting there doing nothing effectively until you need to recover. But now we're making that data more valuable to our customers, right? And hopefully our managed service providers, our VCSPs, can take this feature and actually, you know, productize it and create services around it as well. So that's kind of my hope.
Oh, that's cool, actually, you'd be able to create services in that regard. The other thing also to think about, though, if you are doing this, is you need to make sure, and when you've talked about this before, is you're probably going to want some faster storage that you're landing on that's going through this path. Like, stop just finding the slowest, cheapest storage for your backup. Obviously, you want faster backups, faster restores, but if you're going to activate that data, it needs to stop being on, you know, this RAID 6 of 7200 or 5400 RPM, you know, crap drives.
Yeah. So absolutely, John, you have to know what you could actually use Veeam for. It's not just the backup and recovery tool. And then that leads quite nicely into some of the enhancements that we've done around actual like instant VM recovery. So if we were to do the comparison between 9.5 update 4 and what's coming in version 10, you're going to see a considerable performance. So, and okay, that's great, but that, just take that back into consideration is that, so we've gone back into our code base and we've just improved life for any existing customer that knows and loves Instant VM Recovery today. We've improved the performance of getting that data. And it was already, like, let's say it was minutes, seconds to get that data back up and running. And now, even from commodity, let's call it DAS, terrible storage, if you like, we can still spin up a number of double-digit virtual machines in a really good time frame.
So is this like enhanced code, or is there a re-architecture of how you're doing your VM recovery?
So no, it's exactly the same, but we've just enhanced what we're doing.
Nice.
The other factor of that is, for those that have ever used Instant VM Recovery, you normally had to go through the right click, you click on your virtual machine, the restore point, etc., and you do it one by one.
Yeah, you couldn't. So
what happens if you've got a stack of 20 in your application stack that you want to bring back? You had to either script it, which was fully there, and you could do that. And to be honest, most people would do it that way. But but actually, from an application stack and being able to recover everything at once, then now in the interface in version 10, you can select all 20 and right click instant VM recovery, and it's all going to fly through from that, wherever that restore point is.
Ah, that is way better.
Well, and this also, that also supports my other favorite use case for instant VM recovery, which is not recovering data, but building another writable copy that some developer can go, you know, abuse in a lab real quick. I think I was talking to one of the PMs, and you'll discover after the fact that instant VM recovery, like half the times it's used, is actually for building labs and avoiding the need to do weird writable snappy things on your primary storage.
And that lands into that data lab story that I touched on, right? That on-demand sandbox, to be able to do that from commodity hardware and be able to deliver a sandbox environment out to your test and dev, or even just using instant VM recovery is another option.
Yeah, I think also the key here is that we're doing it, you know, without any dedicated hardware to accelerate. A lot of the competition require SSD to do and to actually have that landing zone for the instant VM recovery. we've been able to do this in software agnostically without the need for specific hardware, right? So, and the actual performance increase has been significant on update 4. So we're quite proud of that as well. So yeah, there's no need to go out and actually buy expensive SSDs. You can, but you don't need to, or you don't need to buy an expensive appliance.
Yeah. Speaking of appliances, I know you guys changed the requirement for for having your proxies being on Windows, where you can actually have Linux proxies now. Is that true?
Yeah. So I mean, this is actually one of my favorite features because we've got a lot of Linux love in this particular release here.
Oh yeah.
But with Linux proxies, though, I mean, what we're able to do is basically stop the I'm a fan of Windows. Regardless, I mean, many people are, right?
Yeah, but are you a fan of Windows licenses?
That's it. There's a stigma attached to it, right? There's a stigma attached. So basically what this allows with customers and VCSPs that do use a lot of proxies and use a lot of Windows proxies, it obviously consumes licenses. Even though we say that you can run them on, Windows XP or, whatever it might be, but obviously we know when people aren't going to do that. The reality here is now you can flip these over to Linux proxies and you're going to save a ton of licenses just on that. But in addition to that, I think obviously because Linux is a much smaller footprint, overall in terms of storage, even the way that it consumes memory and RAM, you're going to get some more efficiencies around that as well. So not only are you saving on licensing, but I feel like you're saving on hardware costs as well and whatnot, and actual cost of running the whole proxy. Now, they don't do everything for mounting. You still need a Windows proxy in there. But for everything else, I would almost automatically go and deploy, replace every Windows proxy with Linux proxy. Still have a Windows proxy in there for a couple of mount operations, but get it in there. And the other great thing about that, and something that Michael and I have been working on quite a bit over the last 18 months, is automation. It's just so much easier to automate these proxies, Linux proxies. I mean, everyone can automate Windows as well. But in terms of time that it takes to, deploy a Linux box and get it out there,
from
a scalability point of view, it's actually going to be quite significant from there. So now we can start to think about things like ephemeral proxies against jobs with the Linux proxy. Whereas before, you knew you had to deploy a Windows server, it was going to take time to configure it. There's just something about Linux that's just a lot nicer for that sort of use case.
Hey, we work in VMware. We know all about it. I mean, we used to have to install Windows just to run vCenter, right?
I was going to ask about this. So these Linux proxies, if we can get it in Linux, and we talk about auto-scaling Linux, why not containers?
One step at a time.
I'm furiously checking Docker Hub for any references to Veeam right now, proxies, but...
I think we've all had those ideas, haven't we, Michael, about how do we much smarter people will work this out than myself, and work out how to actually containerize our situations, our services and whatnot. Look, naturally, I think that could happen, but let's start with getting these Linuxes out there.
No, and I think that's a great idea. And Anthony, from what I know about you, I know you like to spend a lot of time with Ansible. I know it's one of your favorite things. But I also know that you love to research Kubernetes. So I something tells me that there might be something to say in the future. But the fact that you guys are now actually being able to support Linux for your proxies, I think is a huge, huge milestone.
Also to add on to, obviously the Linux proxies is like probably the biggest feature coming from a Linux point of view, but also worth mentioning is around leveraging XFS and there as a file system to be able to use as a backup repository, but not just XFS. We've always been able to do that, but using their block clone technology. So very similar to what we do with Windows ReFS and how we work there to make it more space efficient. So we're going to work with the XFS, I think it's called RefLink, to give us the same block clone technology savings that you're seeing from a similar point of view, from a Windows point of view. But again, it means that our repository server can then also be Linux and run that flavor with direct attached storage.
Nice.
As well.
Sweet. My goodness, man. We are scratching the surface. Obviously, we spent a lot of time talking about backup and recovery, which is beautiful. But man, you guys have a lot more different products than that, right? I mean, there's Veeam One. You've got the agent updates. There's about 10 different products that are tied into this release. My assumption is that each and every one of these is going to have, could be an episode on its own, but there's going to be new updates to all these different areas inside of Veeam, all under the umbrella of V10. I would refer, obviously, if you haven't already, head over to Veeam's website. The launch is today. And again, that's at go.veeam.com/V10. There's going to be a lot of announcements. There's going to be a lot of documentation out there. So be sure to check out this V10. I think this is going to be a pretty huge milestone in terms of backup recovery and all things availability. Gentlemen, thank you for joining. John, anything before we let these gentlemen go?
No, that's a lot to chew on, man.
Absolutely. Mike, Anthony, anything before we take off?
The one thing I forgot was snapshotless processing. So we already use your VMware engine, right, to take the snapshot. What we're doing is in V10, for those high I/O workloads, the Oracle, the SAP, the SQL, we can actually bypass that VMware snapshot and go straight down to the storage snapshot and take an application consistent snapshot.
Oh my goodness.
Customers where they've not been able to because of limitations on certain snapshots.
The other thing also is there are certain things you can't take a snap of, like it just doesn't allow. So if you're using the shared bus for Oracle rack, or if you're doing FCI clustering on SQL, you can't snap those BMDKs yet. And so you need a solution there.
Oh yeah.
So this will give us a way of orchestrating an application consistent snapshot without having to take a traditional VMware snapshot.
Well said. Yeah, that's important. I like that. Very, very politically correct.
Politically correct. You and I did a session that a VP was very annoyed with the title of, called Snapshots Suck at VMworld.
We did. We don't need to bring that back up, John. We're trying to keep our jobs. Come on, man. All right. Well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at thespeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to Michael Cade and Anthony Spiteri for joining us this week. We love V10 and we're back next week. But until then, bye for now.
Enough of this jibber jabber.